thank you and good morning. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. I know for some of you it is an early hour. Just a couple of quick housekeeping notes before I turn it over to Jeff to walk through the presentation that you all should have on your screen. First of all, if you are having technical problems, please email Taryn. We'll try to help you work through those. Also, you should have received from Taryn just a few minutes ago a PDF copy of the PowerPoint. Just in case the webinar for some reason cuts out, you can follow along through the conference call. Again, if you have any questions, please email Taryn, and we'll do our best to help you out. And with that, Jeff, I turn it over to you.
Okay, thanks, Matt, and thanks, everyone, for joining us this morning. We thought the release of this morning's Prospective Plannings Report represented a good opportunity for us to share some of our thoughts with you all about the 2011 corn outlook, what's going on with ethanol production and food prices. Obviously, higher corn prices and tightness in the market over the last few months has started to stir up the food versus fuel debate again. So we wanted to take some time this morning to share the ethanol industry's side of the story. So I've got about 20 slides or so that I was going to walk through, and then would be happy to take some questions, as Matt indicated, at the end. So by now, I'm sure you've all probably had a chance to at least skim the Prospective Plannings Report that was released an hour and a half or so ago. The report showed that farmers intend to plant 92.2 million acres to corn this spring. That's up about 5% from last year. And that would be the highest level of corn acres since we saw the 93.6 million in 2007. The pre-report trade estimates were around 91.8 million acres, so this morning's report was slightly higher than what the trade was expecting, but generally in line. Prospective bean acres came in at 76.6 million acres, which was just a tad below the analyst expectations of 76.9 million. Wheat acres are pegged in this morning's report at 58 million, which is slightly above the analyst expectations of 57.3 million. Cotton plantings were estimated at 12.6 million acres, which is about half a million acres lower than what the trade was expecting to see. So clearly, I think what we saw in this morning's report is that farmers are, in fact, responding to the price signals from the marketplace and planting more of what the market is demanding. The total acres for these nine crops that are shown in the table here sums up to 254.2 million acres, and that's up about 4% from last year, about 10 million acres, as you can see. You know, I wanted to remind everybody, and there's some language on the left side of the screen there, that these numbers should be taken with a grain of salt. These are just farmers' intentions based on surveys conducted earlier this month. USDA does have a pretty good track record with these numbers, but just in the case of corn, they're generally off by an average of about 1.1 million acres over the last 20 years. Sometimes they're a heck of a lot closer than that, but sometimes they're farther away too. And it's at least with corn, it's been about 50-50 in terms of overestimating versus underestimating. Actually, 60-40, as you can see there. So while the total acres for the nine crops that I showed on the last slide are up this year, they are generally in line with historical trends. In fact, just as recently as 2008, we saw actual planted acres for those crops at 254 million acres, which is virtually identical to what this morning's report was showing. So, I'm sure we're going to see lots of headlines about a 10 million acre expansion. But if you look over the last 15, 20 years, that 254 million acres is certainly not out of the realm of normalcy. The 15-year average for cotton, wheat, coarse grains, and oil seeds is 251 million acres. It's been as high as 260 million acres in the mid and late 1990s. So again, you know, there's this notion out there that farmers are needing to convert lots of pasture and hay ground and even, you know, non-agricultural land to crops to meet increased demands. And this chart shows that that just isn't really happening. There is some idle cropland that transitions in and out of production based on what's happening in the marketplace, based on the market signals. So the point here, the point of this chart, obviously, is that over the last several years, increases in corn and soybean acres have come primarily through crop switching and not through land expansion. As you can see, if you look at the red area at the bottom of the chart, that's the area for coarse grains, that appears relatively flat over the last 15 years with the exception of the spike in 2007. And that's because what you're seeing with those coarse grains is increases in corn acres have largely been offset by decreases in the minor feed grains like barley, oats, and sorghum. So to get a rough idea of how corn supply and demand might look in the 2011-2012 marketing year, we took this morning's prospective corn acre number and looked at several different average yield scenarios. We looked at what would happen if we saw a yield like last year, which was far below trend and reflected unfavorable growing conditions throughout much of the Corn Belt for most of the year. We also looked at the USDA trend yield number, which is 162 bushels per acre. We looked at the 2009 average yield, which was a record yield, of course, of about 165 bushels per acre. And finally, we looked at what would happen if everything lines up and we have very favorable weather conditions through the growing season that would produce something on the order of 167 bushels per acre. So we wanted to look at the possible impact of these various yield levels on carryout. So we needed, obviously, to make an assumption about 2011-12 demand. And most of the analysts that I follow have demand in the range of 13.65, maybe up to 13.7 billion bushels in the coming marketing year, which would be about a 1% increase over the current marketing year. USDA won't publish its new crop demand estimates until May, so we're just using this estimate for now. So if you take this morning's corn acre number and assume that about 6.8 million of those planted acres won't be harvested, which has generally been the average difference between planted and harvested acres over the last couple decades, and then if you multiply those harvested acres against these yield numbers, this is what you get in terms of overall corn production. With that worst case corn yield of 153 bushels per acre, you see that we just get over a 13 billion bushel crop. With USDA's trend yield of 162, we'd end up with a record crop of 13.8 billion bushels. If we were able to repeat 2009's average yield of 165, or if we did better than that and got 167, then would expect to see a crop over 14 billion bushels, which would obviously be a record by far. So what would that mean for carryout? Using an assumption, a demand assumption of 13.65 billion bushels, you can estimate likely carryout for 2011-2012. Obviously, the usage number would rise or fall based on prices. There would be adjustments. But the idea here is just to get a rough ballpark of what carryout might look like. Obviously, the worst-case yield would spell trouble for the marketplace. I'm sure I'm not telling you anything you don't already know, and as far as that goes. Certainly, we wouldn't see stocks erode to 100 million bushels like it shows on this chart, because prices would increase to ration demand before that would happen. But it does illustrate just how important it is that we get a trend yield or better this year. USDA's trend yield would actually result in carryout growing by almost 30%, up to 870 million bushels or so. I think USDA said at the Ag Outlook Forum that they we're expecting corn carry out at 850 million bushels or so. So that's real close to what they said a month ago. Then the 165 bushel per acre figure would likely get us back over a billion bushels in carryout. And if we were lucky enough to get 167 bushels to the acre, that would get us back to about 1.3 billion bushels in carryout. So here are, you know, the implications of those various average yield levels. And kind of the simple scenarios that I just walked through. It looks like we're going to need a yield of about 160 bushels per acre just to maintain carryout at its current level of about 675 million bushels. It would take a yield of about 163.5 bushels per acre to get us back around a billion bushels in carryout. So in any case, I think we're very likely looking at a record crop in 2011. 13.8 to 14 billion bushels seems like a very likely outcome, of course, depending on where average yields turn out. Now let's take a look at what ethanol demand and production for 2011 and 12, marketing year, might be. If you take the calendar year RFS requirements for 2011 and 2012 and apply them to the marketing year, you get a requirement of 13 billion gallons of conventional biofuel. And just for some context, the industry produced 13.2 billion gallons in 2010. So we're already producing well in excess of that 13 billion gallon RFS requirement. However, based on expected gasoline demand, we estimate the E10 blend wall is about 13.6 billion gallons, which is actually slightly below the recent run rate that the industry has been running in recent weeks and months. So far this year, the industry is averaging right at about 900,000 barrels per day, which on an annualized basis is 13.75 billion gallons or so. So that additional production above and beyond the blend wall levels has been going to the export market. We don't expect the partial E15 waiver to have much impact on ethanol demand in the upcoming marketing year, but we do expect continued strong exports, and we think we could very easily see 400 to 500 million gallons of exports again, or maybe even more. So we think there's a reasonable expectation for ethanol production in the 2011-12 marketing year to be in the range of 13.8 to 14 billion gallons, and that would imply right about 5 billion bushels of corn use on a gross basis. Remember that a third of every one of those bushels is actually producing animal feed, and we'll talk more about that in a moment. One other point we wanted to make here is we think USDA may actually be underestimating ethanol yields, especially based on the fact that the 2010 crop was of exceptional quality and high test weights. We're hearing lots of plants getting 2.9 gallons per bushel or better, and it appears as if USDA has been using an ethanol yield number of 2.7 gallons per bushel or somewhere in that range. And that obviously can make a big difference when we're talking about corn usage. You know, on that note, we wanted to clear up something that we keep seeing over and over in the media, and that is the notion that we're using 40% of the 2010 crop for ethanol. We've seen headlines that say 4 out of every 10 rows are being used for fuel instead of food. And that's just not true. The pie chart on this slide shows that when you consider that one-third of every bushel processed by an ethanol plant is ending up back in the animal feed market, the net usage of the 2010-11 corn supply by the ethanol industry is less than one quarter. It's 23% to be exact. So that's a far cry from 40%. Obviously, the remaining 77% of the supply is being used primarily for feed, here in the U.S. and abroad, and a small portion is being used for food processing, and you can see how that breaks down there. So we really need to get people thinking of corn use for ethanol in net usage terms, and we certainly appreciate your help in conveying that message. So what about food prices now? We're hearing lots of reports and seeing lots of hand-waving about the possibility of a new food crisis emerging. And, of course, there are plenty of folks who want to point the finger at the ethanol industry for supposedly being the driver behind higher food prices. Well, the facts are that food inflation in 2011 isn't expected to be out of line with normal food inflation rates. If you look over the last three decades, the average annual food inflation has been about 3.5%. That's from 1980 forward. Obviously, it's 1970s were kind of an outlier with in terms of inflation. But from 1980 forward, the average annual food inflation rate has been about 3.5%. USDA this year is projecting food inflation will be between 3 and 4%. So right in line with that long-term average. When you put things in context, if anything has been abnormal about food inflation rates, it's been the last 2 years. We saw food inflation at less than 1% last year, which was the lowest in almost 50 years. And it was just 2% the year before that. So, again, when you take a longer view of food inflation, we're not expecting 2011 to be out of sync with previous years. So far this year, the drivers of higher food prices have been higher energy prices and increases in the fruit and vegetables index, as well as the meat index. You know, you've probably heard us say lots of times that there are many factors that contribute to food prices, and any objective analysis needs to take into account the number of factors that play into setting food prices at the retail level. Every objective reanalysis of the 2008 food price run-up has found that a number of factors were at play. And we had a perfect storm of sorts in 2008. Even researchers who at the time thought biofuels were playing a big role in food prices have since reevaluated the situation, and they've concluded that there were a lot of other things going on that had larger impacts. The 2010 World Bank report is a good example of that. They looked, kind of reevaluated a 2008 report that they'd written and said, yeah, biofuels really weren't much of a factor, and speculation in the commodities markets was probably having a much larger impact. This chart simply shows just some of the factors that drive food prices, and we've generally broken those factors into three broad areas that you can see across the top there. But I think what's important to take away from this slide is that these factors are really interlinked, and you can't just easily disentangle them and point to any one of these single factors and say that factor alone is what's driving food prices. So while there are a number of factors that drive food prices, there is broad agreement that one of the most important factors that figures into food pricing is energy costs. Every step in the food supply chain, from the farmer to the processor to the shipper to the grocery store, they're all affected by energy prices. And obviously we've seen quite a run-up in energy prices over the last several months. Anybody who's bought gasoline recently would agree with that. And this slide just shows the CPI for energy, and it clearly shows that we're seeing a very steep rate of increase over the past 6 months or so. And it's a rate of increase that we haven't seen since the big commodity spike in 2008. This slide just drives that point home a little further by focusing just on petroleum. As you folks all know, oil prices are well over $100 a barrel again. And as a result of that, we're seeing gasoline prices at $3.60 a gallon and diesel at nearly $4 a gallon at the retail level. Food processors and shippers who are facing higher diesel fuel costs are very quick to pass those higher fuel and higher transportation costs to retailers, who then in turn mark up their prices for consumers. We've also seen a huge increase in the amount of speculative investment from hedge funds and commodity pools and other big investors in the commodities markets. In fact, we're seeing even more speculative interest now than we saw in 2008 during the big commodities bubble then. There's strong evidence, and there's been much written suggesting that when there's this much speculative interest in the market, the highs are higher than they probably should be based on fundamentals. The lows are lower, and there's just generally more volatility. What this chart here shows is that when you overlay nearby corn futures prices over net long positions held just by non-commercial investors, you see almost a perfect correlation between non-commercial net longs and corn prices. And I would point out that this chart doesn't include index traders, which are holding another, 450,000 corn contracts and are part of that speculative link. So non-commercial and index traders together are holding about 800,000 net long positions, which is the equivalent of 4 billion bushels of corn. And as it says there on a slide, these speculators, who will really never see a kernel of this corn, hold more contracts on corn than the actual commercial users. And again, this is of great concern to not only the ethanol industry, but other end users of corn, as well as users of other commodities. We've seen the same thing in the oil in oil markets. The weaker dollar is also driving corn prices, and by supporting strong export demand. Obviously, when U.S. commodities are cheaper for foreign buyers, when our dollar is weak relative to other currencies, we're going to see heightened export demand, and we are seeing that currently. So what about corn's relationship to retail food prices? We commissioned Informa Economics a few years ago to really dive deeply into the statistical relationship between corn prices and retail and the food CPI, and they found that there's virtually no statistical relationship between corn prices and the CPI for food. And we think the results are as true today as they were when this study was released in December of 2007. Informa even tried lagging the relationship to allow time for higher corn prices to work through to the retail food level, and they still found a very weak relationship. This scatter graph from that study is probably a bit hard to see, but it shows food prices as a function of corn prices, and you can see just how weak that relationship is. The R squared here is 0.04, which is about as close to a zero relationship as you can get. And the reason there's virtually no statistical relationship is because corn is such a minor cost component of retail food items. If you take a box of cornflakes or a bag of corn chips, for instance, the value of corn in that box of cereal or in that bag of chips is literally just pennies. So even if the price of corn increases by 50%, the price increase for that box of cornflakes, based on the change in corn values, is only going to be 2 or 3 cents. So we're talking about, 0.5% of the retail price of that $4 box of cornflakes. And that's true to a lesser extent, even for meat, milk, and eggs. If all of the increase in corn prices was passed through to the consumer, which is unlikely, the retail cost increase, even for those products, would be minor, and you see a few examples of that in the table here. Obviously, corn is not an ingredient in all or even half of the items in the consumer food basket. So it's just disingenuous to suggest that that an increase in corn is driving higher retail food prices. And this slide further emphasizes just how little of the retail food dollar actually pays for the value of farm goods. This is very new analysis from USDA. It was released just a few weeks ago. It shows that just 12 cents of every dollar spent at the retail level on food makes its way back to farm or agribusiness, to the farms or agribusinesses that provided the raw ingredients for the packaged material, packaged good, or the food at the restaurant. Everything else, the other 88 cents of that dollar, is paying for all the other costs associated with getting that food from the farm to the grocery store shelves or to the plate at the restaurant. That 88 cents is paying for energy and food processing, packaging, transportation, labor, and lots of other costs. And I think it's important to point out that energy affects every one of the slices of that food dollar. When oil prices rise, it hits virtually every link of that supply chain, and those are the easiest cost increases to pass on rapidly to consumers. I've alluded to this a few times already, and most of you probably already know this, but I just feel like it can't be underscored enough. It just seems like this story just isn't getting out there. The ethanol process uses only the starch portion of the corn kernel, which is about two-thirds by weight of the kernel. The remaining third of that corn kernel is protein, fat, and fiber, mostly. And those components are maintained and passed through the ethanol process in the form of distiller's grains, or in the case of wet mills, corn gluten feed or corn gluten meal. So really, a third of every bushel that is processed by an ethanol plant remains in the animal feed market. And you can see the nutrient profile for distiller's dried grains with solubles at the bottom of this chart compared to corn. And the bottom line here is that the protein, fat, and fiber are concentrated and essentially multiplied by a factor of three in the distiller's grains. And so you end up with a product that has about three times the protein content as corn. It's a mid-protein, high-energy feed for livestock and poultry. And we're seeing a lot of this product being fed and very, very high demand, strong demand, and good prices for distiller's grains. These distiller's grains and the other co-products from ethanol production are replacing the need for an awful lot of corn and protein meal in livestock and poultry rations around the world. And really, I think it's almost been under the radar. These co-products are now a huge component of the U.S. feed complex. We produced nearly 35 million metric tons in the 2009-10 marketing year, and we'll be really close to 40 million metric tons this year. And just for the sake of context, that's more than the amount of soybean meal that this country produces. And as you'll see in a moment, exports of distiller's grains are booming. Exports in the 2010 calendar year were right at 9 million metric tons, and this product is truly being fed all over the world. You know, it seems like a myth that just won't seem to die is the notion that increased use of corn for ethanol is reducing the amount of corn that we have available for export. And this chart shows that that just isn't true. It shows corn exports in blue, and stacked on top of corn exports in red is distiller's grains exports. And the green line represents corn use for ethanol. So you can see that combined, the exports of corn and distiller's grains have been trending upward in recent years, even while ethanol use has been expanding rapidly. There's also this notion out there that the U.S. ethanol industry is just gobbling up the world's grain supply to produce fuel, and obviously that just is not true. The industry remains a relatively small user of the world's grain supplies, as this chart shows. In the current marketing year, USDA is estimating the industry will use 126 million metric tons of corn. Again, that's on a gross basis. When you back out the amount of that grain that remains available to the feed market in the form of distillers' grains and corn gluten feed, you get net usage of 88 million metric tons. And that represents just 3% of the total global grain supply. And importantly, as it says there on the slide, we don't use any food grains. We don't use wheat or rice to produce ethanol here in the United States. But even more important than just looking at ethanol use in terms of percentages is to look at absolute use. The 3% we are using is coming from new incremental production. Grain is not being diverted away from food and feed markets for fuel use. We see the use of that diversion term time and again in the media, and really that's where the whole notion of food versus fuel stems from, is this false notion that that the market has to make a choice between using this grain for one or the other. If you look at this chart, what you see is that the amount of grain available for non-ethanol use, that's the red area, is growing. So even after the U.S. ethanol industry uses its 2 or 3% of the global supply, there's still more left for other uses than there's ever been before. And just as a comparative example of that, you can see that in the 2000-2001 marketing year, there was 2.39 million metric tons available after accounting for U.S. ethanol use. 10 years later, after you take out that 88 million metric tons, there's still 2.6 billion metric tons left for other uses, or 8% more than what we saw in the 2000-2001 marketing year. So again, we just wanted to share some of these facts and numbers and data with you all this morning, kind of give you our side of the story and our thoughts on the outlook for 2011.